You're listening to Health First, heard across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
We have Mary DeMocker, author of The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution, with us today. Mary studied at Eastman School of Music and University of Oregon School of Music and has performed widely. She has reveled in an artistic life, performing harp, dressing sets for film productions, and using art to mobilize us for climate justice in so many ways. So welcome, Mary.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What a beautiful book. It's so energetically entertaining to get you moving through things that are usually just tough data and hard to believe. So whatever caused you to write this book?
Well, you know, it's the book that I would have liked when I was raising my children. And I found that once I was really working with families and, you know, a lot of our activism was artwork, the parents would get involved sometimes, coming to watch their children, and then they would ask me, you know, what 5 or 10 things can I do to make a difference? And so I started out with 5 or 10, and it turned into a book, over 100
things. So what are some of the ones that you're the most passionate about right now that you're working on in your life?
Well, for me, I think unleashing art is wonderful with people all ages. And so that's something that's really connecting, and it's great for kids' moods, and it actually is also really good at getting media attention and engaging people in a new way. So that could be just through, we've done prayer flag projects where children, you know, write on small, people of all ages, write on, you know, those prayer flags like they have in Tibet where there are prayers and wishes, and people put their own wishes on for the earth or for their families, for their health, and we've strung those up in public places, and that's just one example. And others are using music or spoken word, you know, to engage in a different way that's not just science or politics.
And there clearly is hope for our planet.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I say there clearly is hope for our planet.
Oh, yes. I mean, things are definitely serious. There's definitely an emergency, and I don't want to downplay that. On the other hand, there's an incredible movement worldwide to transition from, you know, dirty energy systems that are hard on our health and on our climate to clean energy systems that are great for the planet and great for people. But we have to do it now, and that's what this book is about, is how can we join that worldwide transition and help it along in ways that are easy.
And it's about encouraging your whole family and working with your family to do it as a group, as a team.
Yes, or with students, or, you know, people, religious leaders can use it with congregations. It's for grandparents. It's for a lot of people who care about families and who work with families. But yes, it is directed mostly to parents.
Okay.
Partly because I'm parenting and trying to engage in these ideas about how to save the environment.
And one of my main things you put even in the first chapter is planting trees, keeping the earth green, keeping greenery going. How can we do that in small ways?
Well, even just planting trees in our own, if we have yards. Planting trees in our yards. Not everybody has those, but there are some public spaces where we can do that. And it was interesting doing the research for this book to learn that you can make a pretty big amount of, you can capture a lot of carbon just with like a size of a space that's about as big as 6 cars can park in. And there are tips about that in my book. But not everybody obviously has access to even that much land. So we can join groups like Plant for a Planet, which is a kid-led group that's trying to plant 1 trillion trees by the year 2020.
That's quite a feat to do that.
They're well on their way. They've planted, I think, 15 billion so far, so they're on their way. Kids are passionate about it. It's a worldwide organization that was started in Europe.
Stirring the passion in the children.
Well, they are passionate themselves. I mean, those kids today are getting climate science and environmental science in ways that I certainly never did when I was in school. And they're connecting everything to everything else. They understand that everything is connected, and they're getting, you know, better science and better ideas about the solutions. And they care about their own futures, and often they care about other animals. So often they're passionate about wildlife. You know, they're passionate about saving orangutans or polar bears or honeybees or, you know, the wildlife that they care about. And that's one way that young people engage with their passion.
One of your chapters is like cultivate used as cool culture. So recycling, reusing. How do you create excitement over that rather than going to the malls and the stores?
Yes, well, we, from the very beginning, because we were living on one income when I was, you know, when we had children, I was mostly home with my kids. And in order to make that work financially, we had to buy everything used. So we just made it fun by, you know, we'd go to garage sales together, and we would, maybe I would bring along some muffins or something, and the kids just grew up with, that's what you do. Or you go to Craigslist when it's time to buy a car. And one of the things we also did was go to thrift stores for clothing. And that was great with my kids until my son, he hit middle school, and he did not want clothes other people had worn. So he kind of made this statement that I am not going to the thrift store with you this year. So I took him to the mall, and I gave him the $70 budget that I would have given him at the thrift store, but it only got him, you know, two T-shirts and a pair of jeans or something. And the next year he realized that he hadn't really worn those clothes, and he hadn't liked them any more than he liked his other clothes, so he decided to join us again for the back-to-school shop at the thrift store. And that time, he came out with about 20 things. And some of them were a little offbeat, and he really liked that. There's some handmade shirts and some kind of silly hats. And then I kind of topped it off with, I took him out to fish and chips and for root beer because there was a food cart nearby. And that just kind of sealed it as, you know, this can be fun, and this can be affordable, and you can find some oddball items, and you can explore with your own personal style.
Mm-hmm. And what do you suggest for young families with the diaper issue? How do we make it easier on the planet that way?
Well, that one, yeah, I really struggled with that when I had kids. You know, the thing that I would suggest is not exactly a very mainstream idea, but it's go diaper-free. That's what I've seen some of my young mom friends doing now, and it seems to work. They train their kids from a young age to actually use the potty, I mean, really from birth. It's kind of miraculous to watch this up close. So there's a chapter about that called Ditch the Diaper. Mm-hmm. And if people aren't quite ready for that, that's a little more hands-on method of potty training right from birth, but it usually cuts the time that children are learned to use the toilet by about half. It's more like 17 months, and the average now is, I think, twice that. So another thing people could do is cloth diapers, or there's compostable diapers in some of the bigger cities. So there are more options now than there were when I was raising kids.
Absolutely. And what are some of the concerns over the regular disposable diapers?
Well, those are just toxic dumps right there. They have petroleum, they have dyes, they have perfumes, and they have polymers, all kinds of polymers in them that are right up against babies' sensitive skin 24/7. And so that's a great place to just look at from a health perspective, not only from, you know, waste perspective, that they take who knows how long to decompose in the landfill. So that's a serious environmental issue, and it's also a serious health issue for our young people that are wearing diapers. It's all the chemicals that are next to their skin, but that they're also inhaling, so it's getting into their lungs. Mm-hmm. One study that I cite in my book says that we should really consider asthma as something that's caused by or exacerbated by disposable diapers.
I saw that, yes. Yeah, that was new to me, but that's pretty profound.
Yes, yeah. And some of the, we did some disposable diapers that were mainstream, and then we did some that were a little less toxic. But what you'll find is that you can't really get away from using some unhealthy aspects, even in the kind of, quote, green diapers. So there's, in my book, there are websites where people can go research what exactly is different in all these different kinds of diapers and what are the options. But in the end, I have to say, I came out of this research and observation of my young friends advocating for diaper-free approach to parenting.
One of your chapters is called Bag the Cow. What was that all about?
Yeah, Bag the Cow. Well, the bag refers to, there are farmers in Argentina that are actually putting these backpacks on cows to capture the methane that they burp and they, you know, that comes out of their rear ends.
Yes.
So Bag the Cow is kind of a wordplay there, because some people are literally bagging their cows with backpacks, but also bagging in the sense of letting go of red meat in particular, because the methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, the methane that is put out into the atmosphere from the cattle industry, the dairy industry, the meat industry, is very, very high. And the amount that we can cut out through, you know, reducing our own meat consumption, but also really looking at ways that the industry can bring down its methane footprint is very profound. That was something that I also was pretty stunned by in my research, was how impactful the meat industry and animal agriculture is on the climate.
And what about if we've got dogs? Let's turn Fido into a climate hero.
Yes. One thing that we can do is just look at the dog food that we are feeding our dogs. Dogs are not what we call obligate carnivores like cats are. So in other words, dogs can actually have a meat-free diet. You have to obviously check with your own, you know, dog's needs and your vet and such. But you can go with vegetarian for most dogs. You can also go for chicken or fish or something that's less carbon intensive than meat from cows is. So that's one place to look, is at the food that you're giving them. And another place to look is, does that food have palm oil in it? And palm oil has a lot of hidden names, but it's in a lot of animal foods, a lot of pet foods, the cereals and the meats, as kind of a filler and to make it the texture nice for people and more attractive. But palm oil plantations are serious climate criminals, in that they are releasing an unbelievable amount of carbon when those plantations are created. And they're created by cutting tropical forest, which releases huge amounts of carbon. Then they burn those forests, which again releases more carbon. Sometimes those fires smolder for weeks or months. And then they plant monocrops. And that process of destroying tropical rainforest is so damaging to the climate, particularly if the fires smolder on and on, as they often do in places like Indonesia.
Mary, we're going to have to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue talking about your wonderful book, The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution.